Podcast Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Mission Impossible Fallout, Teen Titans Go to the Movies, and 8th Grade. I'm also going to be talking about some news, Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness and Memoirs of an Invisible Man. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can also find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
I was originally planning on doing a whole spot here about news from Comic-Con that I wanted to talk about that I found interesting and releases and premieres and all that good stuff. But something else completely gobbled up the news cycle on that. And it was not an accident that it happened over last weekend at that time because it got maximum exposure at Comic-Con. And I have to talk about it now because I think this is extremely important. And that is what happened with James Gunn and the Guardians of the Galaxy film series. Now, if you don't have the background, if you haven't been following this, basically what happened is James Gunn had started his life as a director and writer at Troma, which if you don't know anything about Troma, Troma has always been a, you use that term, provocateur kind of movie house. Their best known movie is The Toxic Avenger, and it goes downhill from there. It's was all about bad taste. Then one of their films is called Surf Nazis Must Die. I mean, these are the kind of movies that they've been doing since the 70s and 80s. And they really kind of hit their stride in the 80s and 90s. But, you know, then James Gunn was working there, and he even wrote the film Romeo and Juliet. If you've ever, you may not have seen it. I only made it through about 30 minutes of that movie. It's very much in bad taste, and it's offensive and gross. And not that I got offended. It's just I didn't find it all that interesting. But James Gunn cut his teeth at Troma, and eventually he got the job to direct Guardians of the Galaxy. They, you know, Marvel plucked him from sort of the independent world. And last week, there was a resurfacing of tweets, and I use that term very specifically. He had done this series of tweets about 8 to 10 years ago. And when I say series of tweets, I mean a lot of tweets. I mean, it wasn't just one or two that squeaked out. It was a whole diatribe. It was a long group of offensive tweets that were essentially jokes about some very taboo subjects, including rape and pedophilia, and they're not in good taste at all. I'm not going to read them on the air. It's not worth it. You can go back and find them. They're not hard to find. They're archived here and there. And they were offensive, and they were provocative. Now, keep in mind, they were, again, just him trying to make jokes through this whole thing. And I'm not saying that I'm not excusing bad jokes, but what I'm saying is they are, in fact, jokes. These were not admissions of guilt or anything like that. These were not, hey, last night, this is what happened. It was trying out like a comedian would try stuff out. Well, he had done these tweets, and nobody cared because he was a writer from Troma, and then when he got the Guardians of the Galaxy gig, it did show up. These people looked at these tweets and they asked him about them. And he answered them and he talked to them. He said, look, I did that years ago. It's not who I am. And I apologize for this. And he kind of went through that whole little apology tour back in 2012. And nobody really cared about that because they're like, oh, you're just making a movie about a tree and a raccoon. Who cares? You know, no. Now it's one of the big movies in the Marvel franchise. And so then these tweets showed up again this past week. And, of course, everyone got offended, and they said, oh, look at this, you're making movies for kids, because Guardians of the Galaxy is aimed at kids. You know, and now that it's big, we're concerned because it's a popular series, not because it's, you know, beforehand, when he answered it before, nobody cared. And so then Disney looked at the tweets, and they cut ties with him. They fired him for the project, for Guardians of the Galaxy 3. And here's why I find that disconcerting. Part of it is why he was targeted in the first place for this. This was not some rape survivor who had stumbled on these tweets and was outraged by him. And this wasn't some group that speaks out against pedophilia who found these tweets and got incensed by them. These tweets were resurfaced by basically political hitmen. They're political bloggers who lean to the, at times, extreme right. I mean, one of them's a Pizzagate guy. Okay. I don't care where you fall in American politics and your thoughts, but, you know, we're talking like Alex Jones level of kooky at times. And they went after Gunn because he had, especially recently, been tweeting a lot of critical stuff against President Trump and the administration. Here's my problem with that. You want to take up your politics with James Gunn, that's fine. But we're supposed to be dealing in politics in the arena of ideas. We are not supposed to be dealing with hit pieces back and forth on people and whataboutism and saying, oh, look what so-and-so did 8 to 10 years ago. If you want to take on James Gunn on his politics, take him on his politics. Go for it. There's plenty of stuff to go after. But don't do a hatchet job. Don't do a hit piece and try and ruin people's lives for stuff that has nothing to do with this. And here's the thing when it comes to James Gunn. These were things he did 8 to 10 years ago. And I'm not going to fall into that game of saying, oh, they were offensive then and they were offensive now and they weren't funny because these jokes aren't funny. No. Anyone who has ever even played Cards Against Humanity loses the moral high ground on whether or not these jokes are funny. You may not particularly like them. I'm not a big fan of rape jokes. I never have been. But I'm not going to play that game of this high and mighty, holier than thou, 2020 hindsight, these weren't funny. It doesn't matter whether they're funny. It doesn't matter if a joke's funny or not. It's what the joke does and in the context when it was made. In particular with James Gunn, this was years ago. It was brought up to him. Disney knew about this. And of course, we're talking about the company that gave us Song of the South. If you're worried about stuff from the past that offends people. And it was okay. He moved on. He's no longer doing it. He hasn't done it for years. And it was the past then. Why are they firing him now? I think that Disney just knee-jerked on this. I think they went a little bit too quickly and they rushed to judgment. And it was a bad move on Disney. Because at this point, you're like, well, if you've done anything in the past, you're now burned forever. And it's different from the Roseanne thing. I know a lot of people say, well, what about Roseanne? And Roseanne has been doing the rounds on the talk show because this gives her ammunition. There's a difference. What Roseanne was fired for was what she tweeted that weekend. She was not fired for dressing up as Hitler in a photo shoot. She was not fired for smoking pot during the Roseanne for President movie. She was not fired for butchering the national anthem and grabbing her crotch on national TV. She was fired for a horribly racist tweet she did that weekend. And you also don't know what's going on behind the scenes as well. This may have also been a last straw. That's my own, but because it was Sarah Gilbert and Wanda Sykes who first took action against that. There's a huge difference between being fired for something you just tweeted and something you tweeted 10 years ago that you've never repeated the behavior since. That's why I stand with James Gunn. And we're in a bad situation if we're going to start firing people for known stuff that they did in the past. That's been addressed and apologized for and corrected. Now, Disney could always walk this back. I think there's always an option for them to do that. And they could come back and say, you know, we thought about this and everything. I think it all will depend on who they try and get to take over the Guardians of the Galaxy movie. Because they could very well approach someone like Taika Waititi and say, oh, could you do this? And have him be like, this is kind of poison fruit at this point. I love doing Thor Ragnarok, but I wouldn't feel comfortable carrying this on. And are they going to keep James Gunn's previous work on this? He's still going to get a writing credit at some point. So you can't completely untangle him from that. This isn't like Roseanne where they actually were able to find a way to make a TV show called The Conners. The bottom line is this is bothersome to me because it was a hit piece. And it had nothing to do with what's going on now, and it had nothing to do with engaging people in the arena of ideas. And it was the wrong reaction. James Gunn did everything right after these tweets. And he still got fired, which was wrong. I was actually going to cover the trailer park, but I don't think I'm going to have time. I think I just got to move on to doing the movie reviews in the next segment, which is going to be Eighth Grade, which I'm going to talk about when I come back from Fat Guys at the Movies. Ooga, 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 chaka, ooga, 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 chaka, ooga, 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 chaka, ooga, ooga.
Ah!
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right into the movie reviews. The first one I want to hit is one that's actually out in limited release now, and it's rolling out. I think it's getting a bigger nationwide release next week, but I thought I'd give it a little bit of coverage here while it's in a couple dozen theaters around the country, and that is Eighth Grade. Comedian Bo Burnham writes and directs this film about a wallflower girl in the last few days of her eighth grade year.
One more week of eighth grade, huh?
Huh?
I said one more week of eighth grade, right?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, huh?
Okay, so growing up can be a little bit scary and weird.
I think you're so cool. Maybe you just need to put yourself out there a little
bit. I'm gonna stop eating with you if you keep doing this.
You said I could say one thing.
I'm really, like, nervous all the time.
Now, I actually brought in a special guest into the magical studio in the sky with me, and that is my son, Ben Carr. Say hello, Ben.
Hello.
Ben is, recently in eighth grade. Tell us a little bit about yourself and why I specifically chose you to see this movie and wanted to have you come on the show and talk about it.
I am becoming a sophomore in high school, and I am a huge fan of Bo Burnham, and I have been really excited for this movie.
You've recently finished eighth grade. So you're going into your sophomore year, which will be your 10th grade. So you were essentially in the same time of your life just about a year or so ago as the girl in this movie, correct?
Yep.
All right. So tell me what your review of the movie is.
All in all, it really sums up my experience in eighth grade. You don't know what lies ahead of you. You are ashamed of what's in your past, and you're sort of like trying to figure out what's going on now.
What do you have to be ashamed about in your past when you're in eighth grade?
A YouTube channel.
we won't talk about here. Okay, so but she's a blogger. She's a vlogger. She's a
vlogger.
Yeah,
video blogger.
And she engages in social media and that sort of thing. I thought it was a very realistic portrayal of eighth graders.
Yeah. The way that she acts and the way that her classmates act is very relatable.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that she perceives other people is also very, like, I feel like I am in her shoes.
Uh-huh. Do you feel like you're past where she is in the movie, or are you still going through it?
I'm definitely past it, because I feel like I found where I am in high school, or at least I think I did.
Yeah,
or I have. And
it may change in the next.
It could change.
So years.
It will change. Let's be honest. But when I was in eighth grade, everything was a mess. I didn't know how to act. I didn't know how to speak. I didn't know how to dress. Most of all,
mm-hmm.
I wore shirts that were too large on me and pants that were too baggy.
Okay.
So I wasn't the most proud of.
You weren't cool and hip.
No.
You're so,
and I am now.
You were so cute though. You were very adorable. Like 7th, 8th grade, and then you kind of just turned into a teenager and
what happened?
Got tall and smelly. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I'm here talking with Ben Carr, who's my son, about the film 8th Grade. Mainly because he's very recently been in eighth grade, just a couple of years ago. I thought it was a really interesting movie to see with you because I have a good memory and I remember what it was like for me to be in eighth grade.
Yeah.
And I kind of found myself in eighth grade. I was more awkward in sixth and seventh grade for sure. In eighth grade, I kind of found myself and then kind of had to refine myself again in high school. So I went through a couple moments of discovery. But I remember what it was like, and I remember the feelings and the emotions, and while I wasn't ever a teenage girl, I lived with one because my sister was 2 years older than me.
Yeah.
And I watched her go through a lot of what this girl's going through, even though there's all the contemporary things like smartphones and Snapchat and YouTube channels and video blogging, and they also deal with realism of modern life in school with lockdown active shooter drills.
Yeah.
In there, which we didn't have. We had tornado drills when I was in school.
I was about to say I haven't had a lockdown drill, but we haven't gone as in-depth. We're just like, stay in your classrooms, block up the door. If the person comes in, knock the gun out of their hand and put it under a trash can.
Wait, hold on a second. The active shooter drills in school basically require you to be a ninja and then hide the gun under a trash can.
Well, it requires you like throw a heavy object at the person to have them drop the gun and then put it under a trash can.
That's insane.
It is.
I mean, I understand the attack the attacker mentality, because if they're coming into, this is just a whole nother level. But put it under a trash can.
It's so that nobody else can grab the gun, and you put it under there so that
usually when these horrible things happen, it's like with an AR-15, that thing doesn't fit under a trash
can. Yeah, they didn't think of that. But it's because when the police come and they see a kid, they see whoever is holding the gun.
They don't want to shoot you.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I understand that. That boggles my mind.
Yeah.
Anyways, this is not about active shooters, and it's just, that's an element of the movie that shows the realism of what it's like to be in school. What I found interesting about the movie was how well he was able to capture the genuineness of the angst and self-loathing that a teenager has, especially early teenager.
Yeah.
And in particular, in this movie, nothing really drastic happens to her. There's a couple points where things swerve into territory that it could become bad, but it's never, nothing catastrophic happens.
Yeah.
She's just kind of living a very normal, mundane life, almost too mundane. But I think where the genuineness comes in is how a teenage girl looks at that. Everything's a catastrophe.
Yeah.
When you're that age, everything is terrible. Everything can be the end of your life. Even if it's something as mundane as
not figuring out what to wear.
Yeah. Just something silly like that. And I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. Being a kid in eighth grade, you obsess over everything, mm-hmm. and every tiny little detail, you have to be like, oh no, why did I say that? Why did I do that? What is everyone going to think of me? And your mind is just a jumbled mess.
And the reality is, as you move on, and nothing big really happens from that.
Yeah.
Nobody cares what you wore.
Yeah.
And you worry about it more yourself. I thought what was interesting is they have this bit with their father. And Bo Burnham, I looked it up. He's, I think, 27 now.
Yeah.
But he came on strong. He became a stand-up, like a well-known national-level stand-up special stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
Like at 19.
Yeah, it's insane.
Yeah, it was extremely early. And he hit fame so fast that I think he's trying to redirect his life now because, you know, he's been doing this for so many years. But the one thing, he's not a parent. He certainly, even if he were a parent, he's not a parent of a teenage girl or a teenager at that age. So there's stuff that the father says that I find very non-genuine. And I don't know whether that's because Bo Burnham's a genius and putting it together, or if it's just showing his own naivete because he can only write effectively for the characters that he has been in. And when he does that, he does it very well.
Yeah.
Being the teenage eighth grader.
Uh-huh.
But as the parent, he's almost talking through the filter of what a eighth grader would hear.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that was deliberate or not, but I thought that was an interesting effect from the movie. Mm. Well, here we have Eighth Grade by Bo Burnham. Ben, what is your final grade on this movie?
It rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
I'm going to say it kind of rocks, simply because I guess it didn't connect to me as well because I'm in my 40s.
Yeah.
It kind of rocks.
That is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Mission Impossible, Fallout, and Teen Titans Go to the Movies. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews with Mission Impossible Fallout. After he loses some plutonium, oops, Ethan Hunt and his team must attempt to get it back before it is used in a nuclear bomb.
Solomon Lane escaped in Paris.
And now the world is at risk.
This is the CIA's mission. You use a scalpel. I prefer a hammer.
This is a bad idea.
Is it ever a good one? Honestly.
He's not just some observer. He's an assassin.
I don't trust anybody outside of this room.
You go rogue, he's been authorized to hunt you down and kill you.
Now, first of all, let's just acknowledge the fact that this plot setup is essentially an Austin Powers joke. If you recall from, I believe it's the first Austin Powers, when Dr. Evil's trying to come up with what he needs to do to get back in the game, he's like, oh, let's just steal a nuclear bomb like we always did. And to be fair, that was an old James Bond joke. I think that was in You Only Live Twice. So yeah, I mean, it's not a bomb yet, but it can become one. It's stolen plutonium. I mean, there's so much plutonium in the world just getting lost in this movie and like Back to the Future. Anyways, so it is kind of a goofy setup. I remember it was like last week when I talked about Mamma Mia 2, and I was saying it's very hard to explain what the movie's about because it's so about nothing that it has to be about everything. There's no real driving plot line in that movie. In this one, all it is about getting this plutonium back. And there's a lot of other stuff happening where their team is being overseen by Angela Bassett in the top of the CIA. And so she sends Henry Cavill and his mustache over to keep an eye on them and keep tabs on them. But so there's like all this stuff happening and swirling around, but it's all just to get this plutonium and get the bad guy from the last couple movies who's just never gone away to get him back in custody. Overall, who cares what it's about? It is done as an excuse to have some really cool stuff happen. And this is where it's like a James Bond movie. Yes, the action and the stunts, all that feels very James Bondish. But I think what makes it very much like James Bond is you don't care what the story's about. I mean, you say, what's your favorite James Bond movie? And somebody might say, it's Goldfinger. Well, what's Goldfinger about? And you kind of have to think and go, oh yeah, this guy's going to radiate all the country's gold supply. Or if you say, my favorite movie is For Your Eyes Only from James Bond. What's that about? Well, yeah, he's skiing and he's doing this. Oh, but he's also, I guess, trying to track down these launch codes that were stolen from a nuclear vessel. So, what it's about is kind of unimportant. It's just how the movie plays out. That's just, as Hitchcock would say, the MacGuffin. Now, this is the sixth Mission Impossible movie. And that's interesting to note because usually when it comes to a franchise, by the time you get to four, it's really circling the drain. Look at the original Batman movies. The first Batman with Tim Burton was good. The second one was good. The third one was kind of stinky. And then by the fourth one, it was garbage. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. The first one was good. The second one was okay. The third one was garbage. And that's kind of how sequels were sort of in this pre-long form series type Marvel. So, I mean, you can count the Marvel movies, but they're all sort of these disparate movies that come together. Star Wars has passed it. You know, people will argue that Indiana Jones was circling the drain at part four, which took 20 years to make. This one, actually, the series, the Mission Impossible movies have gotten better as they've gone along. And I don't know if I'd say that this is better than Ghost Protocol, because that's actually my favorite of the series. But by the time it hit Ghost Protocol and then Rogue Nation and now Fallout, all of these are good action movies. These are good, exciting international thrillers. And that's impressive. The best I can describe them, compare them to, would be something like the Fast and Furious films. It took four movies to get Fast and Furious to kind of hit that stride. Actually, five really before it really hit the stride of what it had become. And you go back and you watch the first ones. You know, I know there's the fans who'll say, "Oh, the Tokyo Drift's the best of them all," but that really didn't hit a stride until four, and then it's kind of just run on in this juggernaut. And that's very much the same thing that's happening with the Mission Impossible movies. The cast is great. You know, it's nice to have the team back. I know my mom hates the first one because it, you know, John Phelps was the bad guy and it destroyed the team. And that's not what the TV show was about, even though De Palma was trying to be a kind of classic when he did it. And she never got around to watching it anything beyond that. And I know other people who watched the first one and they were done, but they've got a team now and they've got the team that actually works. So it's not the same team from the first movie or from the TV show, but it is a team. You got Simon Pegg, you got Ving Rhames. Now you've got Rebecca Ferguson showing up in there. And so you got all these people that you like from the other movies working in the plot, and that's really good. But also it's the stunts and the action. I mean, these are kind of brilliant to watch. And there's a huge difference between putting something together completely in a computer, which we've seen plenty of this summer, everything from Avengers to Mamma Mia had so much CGI and digital trickery in that. it's just nice to see practical effects and practical stunts. And Tom Cruise is making a career out of doing that. And, you know, good for him. I mean, yeah, he's goofy and he's weird and he's got, you know, bonkers ideas on religion and his relationships are kind of weird and strange. But doggone it, if he's not a bona fide movie star. And yeah, I may, you know, face similar damage when I'm spraining my ankle or twisting a muscle walking to the fridge to get a can of soda. He's jumping off of buildings and dangling from helicopters, and that is an impressive thing to do, even at his age, in the 50s. But most actors don't do that, and it makes a difference. You watch these action sequences in these movies, and you see him bona fide dangling off a helicopter, which is awesome. You never really got that, and especially in the early Bond movies. It'd be like a stunt guy dangling off a helicopter, and then a really bad insert with a rear projection shot of Roger Moore. This is the most impressive thing, and I think that's what makes these movies so enjoyable and such big screen events. So I'm going to have to say that Mission Impossible Fallout is a lot of fun and a great last-ditch effort for the summer movie season. It totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the next movie, which is Teen Titans Go to the Movies. Based on the Cartoon Network series, the story follows a smaller team of teenage superheroes as they try to get a movie made out of their adventures.
It's the superhero movie to end all superhero movies.
He farted.
That wasn't a fart. That was just air leaving my butt.
Which is a fart.
Teen Titans Go to the Movies. Because if Aquaman can get a movie, anyone can.
This is based, like I said, on a Cartoon Network show, and it skews younger. It's sort of, the best way I can describe it is it's sort of like the Fairly Odd Parents, Timmy Turner type of stuff. I mean, it's a kid's show. And when I say kid's show, I'm talking about like a 6-7-year-old is really the target market. Don't expect something heavy like The Dark Knight or something like that. It's whimsical and silly, and it's funny. It's kind of that sort of Powerpuff Girls irreverence to it, but it is a kid's movie. If you said it was made from comic books, it wasn't even the Teen Titans, the original comic books Teen Titans, although I think it's a launching pad for that series, which will be coming to Cartoon Networks. Don't hold that against it. It's still kind of a cute little movie. I mean, I took my 10-year-old to go see it, and he's just ready to leave that target market. I mean, this movie has a lot of fart jokes in it. It also has a lot of jokes that are funny to the adults. There's stuff that is irreverent and that the kids aren't going to get necessarily. And I can appreciate that. Although it still is a goofy kids show. You know, you got that DC direct-to-video movies like The Death of Superman, I think, it just came out or is coming out on DVD and Blu-ray. Those are more grown-up cartoons. This is still a kid show. But I mean, like I said, if you can deal with the, you know, the fart jokes and the goofy humor, there's one scene in there, and it's in the trailer. Actually, you hear a bit of it. But it's a fart joke that goes on and on. And the funniest part about it isn't actually watching it play on screen. It's listening to the kids in the audience start laughing. Normally, kids in an audience are annoying. But you're watching it and the kids start giggling and they start laughing. And by the time they're done with the bit, the whole place is in stitches. People are howling because the fart goes on forever. And if you can't appreciate the humor of listening to kids appreciate that humor, you're not going to like this movie is the best way I can do it. I mean, let's bring it all back to that. Still, Teen Titans Go to the Movies is a cute enough film and worth checking out, especially if you've got kids. It kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the box office and the home cinema roundup featuring new Blu-rays of John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness and Memoirs of an Invisible Man. Batman! And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the show by looking at the box office. Last week, it was actually kind of a shock because, let's call it the shock office, because everybody was thinking that Mamma Mia 2 was going to win. And Mamma Mia 2 did fine. And it did make, when all was said and done, when everything shook out, it made just a hair under $35 million, which is pretty good for it. I don't think it's going to have the longevity or the legs that the first film had, I think this is going to drop off fast. I think the studio's banking on this just sticking around for a while. I don't know. We'll see what happens in a couple weeks. But usually with movies like this, usually by the time you get to the third one is when people lose interest for sure. Especially that's what happened with Pitch Perfect 3. But Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again was overtaken by Denzel Washington in The Equalizer 2, which was kind of amazing because that one really overperformed. They were predicting like the 20s for this one, and it made $36 million. Bested Mamma Mia by $1 million, and it was a cheaper movie. So, you know, in the terms of the battle of the sequels, Denzel Washington won. Now, what's interesting is if you look at the box office, you look at the spread of it, in the top 10, there are only two movies that aren't sequels. And that was Skyscraper at number 6 and Sorry to Bother You at number 10. But then when you go past that in the top 12, the next two are also sequels. So this business of people saying, is Hollywood out of original ideas? Maybe. I mean, there are original movies still being made, but sequels do well. Evidenced by the fact that the top 5 movies of last weekend, The Equalizer 2, Mamma Mia, Hotel Transylvania, Ant-Man and the Wasp, and Incredibles 2, were all sequels. Then you have Jurassic World and the first Purge in the top 10. Oh, and Unfriended as well. Unfriended didn't do terribly well. It was like $3.6 million, but that's enough to overcome its $1 million budget. But yeah, those are all sequels. Sequels tend to do well. They've always kind of done well. And yeah, we're getting a lot of them, but there's also a lot of smaller movies that don't get the wide releases, or they don't get the big, huge money, but they can squeak out with $10 or $12 million, and that's usually enough to get them going. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. I'm jumping into this one early this week because I want to talk about two new Blu-rays from Shout Factory, technically from Scream Factory. That's their genre label. They've been releasing a bunch of John Carpenter's old movies on Blu-ray. In particular, this week, new to Blu-ray, let's talk about Memoirs of an Invisible Man, because this is actually an interesting one to hit. It was the first one that came out of these two. After a freak accident leaves a man invisible, he finds himself on the run from government agents.
Something's happened at the Magnoscopics facility in Santa Mira.
Next thing I knew, I went from high profile to no profile.
What have they done to me?
Wait a minute, who are you guys?
Keep your mouths shut, all of you. You're in a state of molecular flux. If you want to live, you're going to have to trust us.
Where have you been? Everybody's looking for you.
I'm here. Sort of.
I want my molecules back!
I don't sleep well. I can see through my eyelids. I can see through the top of my head.
What I find fascinating about Memoirs of an Invisible Man is it was one of those movies made. It was in the early 90s, and we were right at the time where actors were still not allowed to play against type. This one stars Chevy Chase, and at the time when Chevy Chase, I think Chevy Chase was trying to do a more serious movie. Now, they do some sort of whimsical Chevy Chase kind of silly stuff in the movie, but that's why he chose John Carpenter. I think he wanted to get a bona fide good Invisible Man movie. And I remember seeing this back in the 90s and actually kind of liking it. And I saw, now it doesn't hold up as well. It gets a little clunky in its pacing. But I still think it's not a bad little Invisible Man movie. It's certainly better than Hollow Man, which was terrible, like made, I don't know, nine or 10 years later. And I love the original Invisible Man with Claude Rains. This one, it does work as a film, but the problem is, since it had Chevy Chase in there and he'd been doing the Fletch movies and the Vacation movies, the studio, which was Warner Brothers at the time, I don't think they allowed him to be serious. And so they take all the funny gags and jokes in the movie that are meant for comic relief and they cram them into a trailer. You can even tell the way that trailer played. It's like low wacky Invisible Man movie when it's really not. It has jokes and one-liners and I think stuff that Chevy Chase still gravitated towards. Nowadays, you could have somebody, you know, like Bill Murray can do a serious movie now and nobody bats an eye. And like we talked about Bo Burnham, who's known for comedy, and you see a movie like Eighth Grade, and that's not a comedy. It has funny scenes in it, but it's not a comedy. It's this very serious depiction of life for a teenage girl. I think now it's a little safer for stars to play with their conventions. No one's boxed in completely as a comedian or as a serious actor, unless they really just aren't good at performing outside of that. But it's not uncommon to see that. And that's the big thing that held back. But this is still, it's kind of a fun movie. It has some focus issues, but I like the sort of the film noir approach to it. And it's groundbreaking in special effects. I mean, the special effects now look, you know, they show their age, but this was amazing to see on the big screen. This was not something that you would see normally. It was groundbreaking special effects back in the early 90s. I haven't seen this movie in over 10 years, probably about 20 years. And it's neat to watch. I still think it's a pretty decent movie, and it's kind of a lark, and it's not a bona fide John Carpenter movie. His name's not even on it as John Carpenter's Memoirs of an Invisible Man. He would always do that. I think he was just looking at it as a hired gun. But I think at that time, John Carpenter was maybe trying to break out, because this is before he really started to lose steam in the late 90s. There are some basic special features like outtakes and behind the scenes and trailers and such on this one, but it's pretty basic. It's a lot of just imported from the old DVD release. So I'm going to have to say Memoirs of an Invisible Man kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish things off with the review of the collector's edition of John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness on Blu-ray from Scream Factory. An insurance investigator searches for a missing author and discovers him in a small town where an ancient evil is ready to break through into our reality.
The riots began because the stores could not meet the demand of Sutter Kane's novel, In the Mouth of Madness.
Kane disappeared 2 months ago without a trace.
I'm the guy that writes horror books.
You can forget about Stephen King. Kane outsells them all. I need to know if he's alive or dead, and I need that book.
It's a setup. I just have to work out how it's set up.
Kane's writing has been known to have an effect on his readers.
This whole thing has been staged. This is not reality.
It's all happening for real.
I had a friend tell me, and she's absolutely right, that this is the best H.P. Lovecraft movie that's not directly based on H.P. Lovecraft's stuff. If you've read H.P. Lovecraft, he's always all about these dark ancient beings, these monstrous, undescribable, tentacle-covered creatures with would go insane just if you saw them. And that's very much H.P. Lovecraft. And this is a homage to H.P. Lovecraft. Even the name, In the Mouth of Madness, is a callback to the book In the Mountains of Madness. This is one of John Carpenter's last great films, in my opinion. And everyone loves Big Trouble in Little China. And don't get me wrong, I think that movie's a lot of fun. But there was this run he had from the late 80s into the 90s that include movies like In the Mouth of Madness and Prince of Darkness and They Live. And those three I thought were some very unique and different movies that were not at all what the horror market was making at the time. And I remember seeing this in the theaters back in the mid-90s when Mouth of Madness came out. And it still holds up. I mean, you talked about Memoirs of the Invisible Man, how it doesn't quite hold up now in another watching over 20 years later. This one does. This one feels eerie and creepy, and it has the tropes of the 90s, and it has the reflection of the 90s and sort of the way the cinematography was. But as a horror story, it still works. And it doesn't just play off of H.P. Lovecraft, but it plays a bit off of Stephen King, who was really huge in the marketplace back then, especially in the movies. This also has some great performances by Sam Neill and Jürgen Prochnow as the writer Sutter Kane. It has a great bit with Charlton Heston as the publisher, Bernie Casey as the insurance company owner who hires Sam Neill. And this is one of those films that's in his Apocalypse trilogy along with Prince of Darkness and The Thing that make it one of John Carpenter's best films. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a fantastic movie and it still holds up. And in the Blu-ray, it's got a bunch of new stuff, including a new audio commentary and a look at the locations and some interviews with Julie Carmen, who played the woman in the movie. She was the editor of Sutter Kane's books. And then there's a bunch of vintage pieces and an old commentary. But overall, I mean, this is a great buy. If you are a big fan of John Carpenter's stuff and you liked In the Mouth of Madness, this is definitely one to pick up. I think this one totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Other DVDs and Blu-rays that are out this week, I talked about Ready Player One last week. That is now available. You can get that physically yourself. And that is it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Christopher Robin and The Spy Who Dumped Me. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.